Hello, you're listening to Some Sounds of Arizona with the Arizona Daily Sun for Wednesday, December the 18th, 2024. I'm Flagstaff volunteer reader Gary. Front page articles include Prosecutor Mangone sought to sow terror in United Healthcare CEO Kelly. Next, Wisconsin police seek answers in rare case of female school shooter. Next, Congress shuffles toward stopgap funding bill. And last, for the front page, Musk, SpaceX face federal reviews over security, NYT reports. Now, moving to the first article. Prosecutor Mangone sought to sow terror in United Healthcare CEO Kelly. By Lou Cohen from Reuters. Luigi Mangone sought to sow terror by shooting to death United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson on a Manhattan street, a New York prosecutor said on Tuesday, in announcing Mangone has been indicted for murder. A grand jury indicted Mangone on 11 counts, including first-degree murder and murder as a crime of terrorism. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg told reporters. Mangone, 26, would face a mandatory sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole if convicted on all counts. This was a frightening, well-planned, targeted murder that was intended to cause shock and attention and intimidation, Bragg told reporters. The intent was to sow terror. Mangone's defense lawyer in New York, Karen Friedman Agnifolo, declined comment. Ivy League-educated Mangone was charged with murder on December the 9th for killing of Thompson outside of a Manhattan hotel before a company conference following a five-day manhunt. Mangone is currently being held on gun charges in Pennsylvania, where he was arrested last week at a McDonald's restaurant in the city of Altoona. Bragg said he had indications that Mangone may waive his right to contest his extradition to New York. A hearing over Mangone's extradition is scheduled for Thursday in Pennsylvania. The killing of Thompson has ignited an outpouring of anger from Americans struggling to receive and pay for medical care. Americans pay more for medical care than any other country, with spending on insurance premiums, out-of-pocket co-payments, pharmaceuticals, and hospital services on the rise in recent years, government data shows. The words deny, defend, and depose were written on shell casings found at the Thompson murder scene, several news outlets reported, evoking the title of a book critical of the insurance industry. Mangone has been celebrated in some circles, and more than 1,000 donations have poured into an online fundraiser for his legal defense. New York Police Commissioner Jessica Trish said any attempt to rationalize Mangone's alleged actions was vile. There is no heroism in what Mangone did, Trish told reporters. We don't celebrate murders, and we don't lionize the killing of anyone. The indictment accuses Mangone of murdering Thompson with the intent to influence the policy of a unit of government by intimidation or coercion. Mangone suffered from chronic back pain that affected his daily life, according to friends and social media posts, although it is unclear whether his own health played a role in the shooting. United Healthcare Group said last week Mangone was not a customer of that insurer. Now moving to the next article, Wisconsin police seek answers in rare case of female school shooter. This is by Brad Brooks and Joseph Axe, Reuters. Police in Wisconsin on Tuesday were interviewing friends and family and examining the online presence of a 15-year-old girl to determine what drove her to open fire in a classroom at her private Christian school, killing a fellow student and a teacher before taking her own life. The shooter, identified by police as Natalie Rupnow, who also went by Samantha, was a student at Abundant Life Christian School in Madison, Wisconsin, the state capital. In one key way, the Madison attack is an outlier among U.S. school and mass shootings. Women and girls are far less likely to conduct them than male attackers. Only about 3% of all U.S. mass shootings are perpetrated by females, studies show. Identifying a motive is our top priority, but at this time it appears that the motive was a combination of factors, Madison Police Chief Sean Barnes said at a press conference. Barnes did not provide additional detail, saying he didn't want to jeopardize the investigation. Investigators are examining her cell phone, computer, and online posts, as well as verifying a possible manifesto the shooter may have left behind. Some details of Rupnow's life have begun to emerge. Police have confirmed the name of the street on which she resided in Madison. Online records show someone named Jeffrey Rupnow lives on the same street, and a Facebook profile belonging to a Jeff Rupnow in Madison shows photos of a newborn daughter named Natalie Lynn from 2009, 15 years ago. Jeff Rupnow's cover photo posted in August shows what appears to be a teenage girl trap shooting with a shotgun at a local club. In a comment on the site, Jeff Rupnow said he and his child joined the club in spring 2024 and have been loving all every second of it. Rupnow could not be reached for comment. The shooting took place in a study hall classroom just before 11 a.m. local time. Previously, Barnes said the first 9/11 call reporting the shooting was placed by a second grade student. On Tuesday, he clarified that the call actually came from a second grade teacher. Two students remain in critical condition while several other victims suffered less serious injuries, officials said. Police said Rupnow used a pistol but have not said how it was obtained. Wisconsin officials said at Tuesday's press conference that it is too early to say if Rupnow's parents could be held legally responsible. Police Chief Barnes said that it appears such charges are not warranted. School shootings have become a common occurrence in the United States, with 322 of them in 2024, according to K-12 school shooting database. That is the second highest total of any year since 1966, topped only by the 2023 total of 349. Dane County Executive Melissa Agard said at the press conference that she wants stricter gun laws in Wisconsin, including red flag laws that could result in guns being confiscated from at-risk people and also laws requiring the safe storage of guns in homes. She urged state and federal legislators to enact better protection. Part of that process is setting aside complacency and demanding change, Agard said. Let us remember this fact. Gun violence is the number one killer of children in this country. That's a legacy we cannot accept. Now moving to our next front page article, Congress shuffles toward stopgap funding bill. This is by Katie Jackson and Richard Cohen from Reuters. U.S. congressional negotiators reached a tentative deal on Tuesday on a stopgap funding bill to avert a partial government shutdown, provide about $100 billion in disaster aid, and $10 billion to farmers, Republican lawmakers said. A Democratic source familiar with the talks confirmed the outline of the tentative deal. Congressional aides were preparing legislation that could be ready for votes later in the week. The Senate aims to then pass it before current funding ceases at midnight ETA Friday and send it promptly to President Joe Biden to sign into law. The measure largely would keep the roughly $6.2 trillion federal budget functioning at its current level, funding such areas as the military, air traffic control, and federal securities markets regulators. The bill is coming together. Bipartisan work is ongoing. We're almost there, Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson told reporters at a press conference. Johnson leads a narrow and restive 29-2011 Republican majority, and over the past year has had to rely repeatedly on Democratic support to pass major legislation. Representative Pete Aguilar, the number 3 House Democrat, told reporters his colleagues want to review the deal carefully. "We want to see the details," he said. "We hope that Speaker Johnson puts this out soon that we can vote. We want to make sure the numbers are right." Representative Chip Roy, a hardline Republican who typically opposes new spending bills, derided the deal. "Swamp is going to swamp, right?" he said. "This is not the way to do business." Johnson said the bill would include $10 billion in economic aid for farmers. Republican Representative Glenn Thompson, who chairs the House Agricultural Committee, welcomed the assistance as wide-ranging farm programs are set to expire at the end of 2024. "The $10 billion is a great start, and I think it's going to send the right signals to the market that most farmers and ranchers are going to be able to get eligible to the credit that they need to borrow in order to plant crop or raise a herd," Thompson said. Republican Representative Pete Sessions told Reuters the measure also contains around $100 billion in funding for recovery initiatives related to hurricanes, wildfire, and other natural disasters. Reuters reported on Monday that the legislation would keep government funding flowing through March 14, 2025. Congress' failures to address the gap between federal revenue and spending has contributed to the rising national debt, currently above $36 trillion. Congress will have to address that again early in 2025 when a 2023 deal to extend the nation's debt ceiling expires. Failure could shock bond markets with potential severe economic consequences. Moving to our next article, Musk, SpaceX face federal reviews over security, NYT reports, and this is by Reuters. Elon Musk and SpaceX face at least 3 federal reviews over whether they have complied with federal reporting rules aimed at protecting national security, the New York Times reported on Tuesday. Such reviews ordinarily occur once instances of a potential infraction come to light, Pentagon officials have said. New York Times said the new reviews were initiated by U.S. Air Force, the Defense Department's Inspector General, and the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence and Security. It cited 8 people with knowledge of the rocket company and internal documents. Elon Musk and his rocket company SpaceX have repeatedly failed to comply with federal reporting protocols aimed at protecting state secrets, including by not providing some details of his meetings with foreign leaders, the newspaper report said. The Air Force and Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence and Security referred queries to the Defense Department's Office of Inspector General. That office, in turn, said that, as a matter of policy, it could neither confirm nor deny the existence of an ongoing investigation. It added, "This is to protect the confidentiality of those involved and to protect the integrity of the investigative process." SpaceX President and Chief Operating Officer Gwynne Shotwell declined to comment on the securities clearance issues or the probes when asked by a Reuters reporter as she left an event in Washington. Musk did not immediately respond to her request for comment. The New York Times said the Air Force recently cited potential security risks in denying high-level security access for Musk, and that allies including Israel have flagged concerns that the billionaire CEO might share sensitive data. Last month, 2 Democratic U.S. Senators, Jeanine Shaheen and Jack Reed, wrote in a letter that reports that Musk has held multiple calls with Russian officials, including President Vladimir Putin, should be investigated by the Pentagon and law enforcement agencies on national security grounds. Now moving to additional articles from the front page. Trump sues Des Moines Register, and this is by Helene Koster and Jack Queen of Reuters. President-elect Donald Trump has filed a lawsuit against the Des Moines Register and its top pollster. Fox News reported the lawsuit on Tuesday, the day after Trump increased his legal threats against news outlets and said he will also consider suing social media influencers and others for defamation. The lawsuit, which Fox said was filed Monday night in Polk County, seeks accountability for brazen election interference committed by the newspaper and pollster J.N. Seltzer over a poll published November the 2nd. That poll showed Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris leading Trump by 13 percentage points in Iowa. Gannett, parent company of Des Moines Register, also is named in the suit. A Gannett representative said the organization stands by its reporting and believes the lawsuit is without merit. In remarks to reporters on Monday, Trump threatened to sue the newspaper. In my opinion, it was fraud and it was election interference, Trump said. It cost a lot of money to do it, but we have to straighten out the press, Trump also told reporters. Some legal experts say Trump's comments and legal actions risk chilling news coverage of the incoming administration, even if legal protection for journalists is sturdy. There is some serious concern that the erosion of legal protections could lead to less aggressive news coverage, said Roy Gutterman, a communications professor at Syracuse University. He pointed to the ABC settlement as a possible example of a news organization fearing retribution from the Trump administration, noting that the high cost of litigation could have also influenced the network's decision. On December 14, Walt Disney-owned ABC News agreed to give $15 million to Trump's presidential library to settle a lawsuit over comments that anchor George Stephanopoulos made on air. The comments involved the civil cases brought against Trump by writer E. Jean Carroll, who accused Trump of sexually assaulting her at a New York department store in the 1990s. Stephanopoulos said Trump was found liable for rape, but a jury found Trump liable for sexual abuse. New York law distinguishes the two offenses. Trump is appealing the jury verdict in that case and a judge's ruling in a related lawsuit brought by Carroll. An ABC News spokesperson said in a statement that the network was pleased that the parties reached an agreement to dismiss the lawsuit. As part of the settlement, ABC agreed to publish an editor's note stating that the network and Stephanopoulos regret statements regarding President Donald J. Trump made during the interview in question. On Monday, Trump also mentioned his lawsuit against CBS News over an interview with Harris that aired on its 60 Minutes News program in October. The lawsuit, which seeks $1 billion in damages, claimed that the interview had been deceptively edited. CBS has said the suit is completely without merit and asked the judge to dismiss the case. Trump claimed on Monday that 60 Minutes participated in fraud and election interference. Any lawsuits by Trump would still face steep hurdles in court because U.S. law has some of the strongest protection in the world for news coverage of public figures. Long-standing legal precedent holds that public figures must prove defendants knew or strongly suspected something was false, but said it anyway. A standard known as actual malice, that is, notoriously difficult to prove in court. Trump has said this legal standard should be changed, and some U.S. Supreme Court justices have expressed willingness to re-examine the precedent. The standard remains a strong one, the strongest in the Western world, said Boston School of Law professor Jeffrey Powell. Even if lawsuits by Trump were to fail, they could create headaches for news organizations by publicly revealing potentially embarrassing internal communications and exposing journalists and executives to depositions. In the ABC lawsuit, some legal experts said the network could have prevailed because Stephanopoulos' comments appeared to be an innocent mistake and not the type of reckless disregard that Trump would have to prove. A judge denied ABC's motion to dismiss the case in July, rejecting the network's claim that it was broadly protected under Florida law, shielding news organizations from liability for accurate reporting on information received from government officials. The order concerned only several initial legal questions and did not suggest Trump would have won. Moving to our next article. Reported drones include aircraft and stars, U.S. officials say. And this is again by Reuters. Many of the drone sightings that have gripped the U.S. appear to be of commercial, hobby, and law enforcement drones, as well as aircraft or stars, U.S. officials said on Tuesday, as they move to bolster areas with more detection capabilities. Fewer than 100 of the more than 5,000 reported sightings in New Jersey and other northeastern U.S. states merit an investigation. Officials at U.S. Department of Defense, U.S. Homeland Security Department, FBI, and FAA said. The sightings, which began in mid-November, have created a social media frenzy. The Facebook group called New Jersey Mystery Drones, Let's Solve It, had nearly 75,000 members as of Monday, with people posting theories ranging from extraterrestrials to foreign actors. U.S. officials reiterated there is no security or personal safety risk from the spate of reported drone activity. The Biden administration was set to give members of the U.S. House Intelligence Committee a classified briefing on the issue later on Tuesday, a Punchbowl reporter said on X. Representatives for the panel could not be reached to comment on the report. The latest statement from the officials, who have repeatedly said most of the large fixed-wing sightings involved manned aircraft, came from U.S. President-elect Donald Trump on Monday, called for more federal comment on the reported sightings. We recognize a concern among many communities, the officials wrote in a statement. We have sent advanced detection technology to the region, and we have sent trained visual observers. The agency also called on Congress to pass legislation when it reconvenes in January that would give them more authority to identify and mitigate any drone threats, noting that there are already more than 1 million lawfully registered drones. There are thousands of commercial, hobbyist, and law enforcement drones lawfully in the sky on any given day. With the technology landscape evolving, we expect that number to increase over time. Now moving to articles from across the American West. The Arizona Supreme Court rules illegally obtained DNA evidence would have been discovered eventually. This is by Jim Small from the Arizona Mirror. Arizona Supreme Court ruled Tuesday that even though police violated a murder suspect's constitutional rights by analyzing his stored blood sample without a warrant, the DNA evidence can still be used against him because of an exception in search and seizure law. The unanimous decision provides new guidance on genetic privacy rights while allowing prosecutors to proceed with their case against Ian Mitchum, who is charged with the 2015 murder of Allison Feldman in Scottsdale. Feldman had been sexually assaulted in her home near Loop 101 and Pima Road and died of blunt force trauma to the head. The case began when Scottsdale police investigated Feldman's murder, analyzed blood that had been taken from Mitchum during a DUI arrest a month before the 31-year-old burn and trauma specialist was killed. That analysis wasn't performed until 2018, after the detectives sought to identify family members of the unknown man who left DNA at the murder scene, which found that Mitchum's incarcerated brother was either a sibling or a parent of the unknown man. Police then turned their investigation to Mitchum and realized they still had his blood sample. Her case was the first in Arizona where familial DNA was used to help track down a suspect. Although Mitchum had consented to the blood draw for alcohol testing and had agreed that any unused blood would be destroyed after 90 days, police never did that. In 2018, they extracted his DNA profile without obtaining a new warrant and matched it to evidence from the murder scene. Although Mitchum lost his possessory rights to the second vial of blood, he did not lose all of his privacy rights in that blood, Chief Justice Ann Timmer wrote for the court. The court held that creating a DNA profile constitutes a separate search requiring its own warrant or exception to warrant requirements, even when police legally possess the biological sample. Their failure to do so violated Mitchum's Fourth Amendment right against unlawful search and seizure. However, the justices ruled the evidence admissible under the inevitable discovery doctrine because Mitchum's later felony convictions would have required him to provide a DNA sample anyway under Arizona law. The ruling requires law enforcement to obtain warrants before conducting new analysis on stored biological samples, but provides flexibility to establish exceptions to warrant requirements. The key inquiry is whether verifiable facts exist from which the court can find that the evidence would have been lawfully discovered despite the illegal search and independent of it, Timmer wrote. Mitchum was indicted in 2018 for first-degree murder, second-degree burglary, and sexual assault in Thielman's death. The trial court initially suppressed the DNA evidence, but Tuesday's ruling overturns that decision and allows prosecutors to use it. The ruling comes as courts nationwide grapple with privacy implications of advancing DNA technology and growing genetic databases. The Arizona Supreme Court's analysis provides a framework for balancing individual privacy rights with law enforcement needs as these technologies continue to evolve. The case now returns to Maricopa Superior Court for further proceedings. Mitchum remains in custody. Now moving to our next article, high-speed internet to expand in rural areas. This is by Leah Romero, New Mexico. Nearly 40,000 households in seven rural New Mexico school districts will receive high-speed home internet in coming months, following state grants from Office of Broadband Access and Expansion Student Connect Program. OBAA's Student Connect Program is within the office's Connect New Mexico Fund, which was established in 2021 by the legislature. It designated $70 million in state funds to expand broadband in unserved and underserved areas, working to connect rural students and education institutions was one of the intentions behind the creation of the fund. Mike Curtis, spokesperson for OBAE, said about $56 million has been awarded through the Connect New Mexico Fund, but the recent award came from the sub-program created specifically to help students. With the award of $13.5 million, two internet service providers and OK Olinda Pueblo will expand high-speed internet connections to 38,482 households, according to an OBAE news release. That ensures students and teachers continue to have access to high-speed internet outside of the school setting. The money will go toward building towers, installing fixed wireless service, and providing receivers to homes. Projects are expected to be completed by June 30th, 2025. Students and school staff benefiting from the home access will receive 3 years of free internet access. Awardees include Resound Networks, based out of Pampa, Texas, Oso Internet Solutions from Rama, New Mexico, and OK Oenge Pueblo in Rio Arriba County. Connections will be extended to remote areas of Dona Ana, Catron, Cibola, Rio Arriba, and Valencia counties, impacting students and teachers in 7 school districts. Bellin Consolidated Schools, Gladson Independent School District grants Cibola County Schools, Hatch Valley Public Schools, Los Lunas Public Schools, Oke Oenga Community School, Oyamondo Independent School District. The Student Connect program grants became available in October and still has about $11.4 million in grants available for applicants. Other Connect New Mexico Fund grants awarded outside of the connection to school districts include areas in Dona Ana, Valencia, Colfax, Sorocco, Grant, Hidalgo, Lincoln, Chavez, Otero, Eddy, Luna, Sierra, and San Miguel counties, as well as Picos, San Ildefonso, Islita, Laguna, and Tezque Pueblo. You're listening to the Arizona Daily Sun from the Flag Status Studios of Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds programming is directed to those who cannot use print material due to a disability. Listen to our live streams and learn how you can support us at the website sunsounds.org. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand. From our website, choose Broadcast, Info, and Audio, then On Demand. Moving to our next article, applications open in Nevada for federally funded community solar. Nevada's Green Bank seeks to distribute $156 million in federal funds to help thousands of low-income households benefit from solar power, whether they own property or not. Although rooftop solar has exploded in popularity, high upfront cost and physical constraints have prevented lower-income residents and renters from reaping the benefits of low-cost solar power. One solution, enabled by the Inflation Reduction Act, directs solar financing to governments, nonprofits, and businesses willing to share at least half of their solar energy gains with low-income households in exchange for millions in upfront financing. The IRA-funded Nevada Clean Energy Fund, the state's first green bank, opened intake applications last week for multifamily affordable housing property owners and community solar hosts that want to take advantage of the hefty federal funding. We are thrilled to begin making financial assistance available under such an unprecedented program in Nevada, said Kristen Staso, CEO of the Nevada Clean Energy Fund. The multi-million dollar Solar for All grant is expected to help finance about 125 multifamily affordable housing and community solar projects across Nevada. These Solar for All projects are expected to lower energy costs by at least 20% for more than 20,000 low-income and disadvantaged households in Nevada by 2029. Nevada received the highest Solar for All grant per capita of any state. In fact, Nevada received the same award amount as Florida, Illinois, and Pennsylvania, states with significantly higher populations. Hosts for community solar projects will be eligible for up to $5 million in funding per installation under the Nevada Solar for All program, while multifamily affordable housing properties could receive up to $2 million in funding per installation. Nevada Clean Energy Fund is aiming to finalize agreements and distribute funds to awardees 60 days after a formal application is submitted. More than 50 potential awardees have already started the initial process to become hosts for solar projects financed through the bank, said Jeanette Zamborano, a community engagement manager for a Nevada Clean Energy Fund. Churches, local governments, nonprofits, and businesses are all potential hosts for community solar sites financed by the Green Bank, Zambrano said. The Green Bank is also working with some of the largest nonprofit affordable housing developers, including Nevada Hand, to identify potential multifamily affordable housing projects. Now moving to some business articles. Grubhub to pay $25 million for misleading customers, restaurants, and drivers. This is by Jody Godoy from Reuters. Grubhub settled with the U.S. Federal Trade Commission and Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul on Tuesday for allegedly misleading customers about order fees, adding restaurants to its platform without their consent, and deceiving drivers about pay. The settlement requires Grubhub to cease the practices and pay $25 million. The agency sought a $140 million judgment against the company, but reduced it to what Grubhub is able to pay, they said. If Grubhub is found to have misrepresented its financial position, the full penalty will apply. A Grubhub spokesperson said on Tuesday, while we categorically deny the allegations made by the FTC, many of which are wrong, misleading, or no longer applicable to our business, we believe settling this matter is in the best interest of Grubhub and allows us to move forward. The food delivery platform hid fees until the last minute, misled Grubhub Plus subscribers to believe they can avoid fees and block some customers from using their gift card balances, according to the lawsuit. Drivers were told they could earn up to $26 per hour, when in reality, only the top 2% achieved these rates, the agency said. Thousands of restaurants were added to the platform without their consent, resulting in order delays and customer complaints, FTC and State of Illinois said. For Grubhub, these misrepresentations are a quick and cheap way to add restaurant offerings and build scale. But Grubhub's deception harms restaurants and diners alike, the agency said. FTC and Illinois alleged the practices violated federal and state law. Our next article, Starbucks Workers Union authorizes potential strike. This is by Reuters. The workers' union, representing more than 10,000 Starbucks baristas, said they have authorized a potential strike prior to the year's final round of bargaining talks with the coffee giant. Workers United, which has a bargaining delegation that represents workers at 525 Starbucks stores in the United States, said the coffee giant has yet to bring a comprehensive economic package to the table, while hundreds of legal disputes over unfair labor practices remain unsettled. The union, which has been urging Starbucks to increase wages and staffing at its stores, as well as implement better schedules, said it had not yet decided on when to go on strike. Starbucks said in emailed statement, the union's move to authorize the strike was disappointing, and that it was committed to reaching a final framework agreement. Negotiations between Starbucks and Workers United began in April on a foundational framework to guide collective bargaining in the country and potentially settle pending legal disputes. The company said it had scheduled and attended more than 8 bargaining sessions with the delegates of Workers United since April and had reached 30 agreements on dozens of topics. The previous round of negotiations took place in September, just weeks after former Chipotle Mexican Grill top boss Brian Nicole's surprise appointment as Starbucks chief. Ahead of the September talks, Nicole, in response to a letter by some baristas from the bargaining delegation, said he was committed to engage constructively with the union. This week, Starbucks raised its paid paternal leave to up to 18 weeks from 6 weeks for workers at its more than 11,000 company-operated stores, which would be applicable from March. The coffee chain is in the midst of a turnaround as Nicole works to bring back coffeehouse culture at Starbucks by implementing an overhaul of its cafes by adding more comfortable seating, reducing customer wait time to less than 4 minutes, and simplifying its menu. Next article. Climate tech firms get $80 million to pull carbon from paper mills and sewage plants. This is by Peter Henderson from Reuters. Google, H&M, Stripe, and other members of the Climate Focused Frontier Community Coalition will buy $80 million of carbon credits from a firm using oil industry technology to capture paper mill emissions and another using rocks to do the same at sewage plants. Although U.S. President-elect Donald Trump is expected to withdraw from a deal to cap global warming and cut support for carbon capture, companies in sectors including tech and finance continue to back efforts to remove carbon from the atmosphere. Unlike efforts to use natural solutions to lock climate-damaging emissions, for example, by planting trees, many tech-heavy fixes are still at an early stage and nowhere near sucking up the billions of tons a year needed. To help bring the cost of the technologies down, Frontier agrees to buy credits from firms with technologies it believes can eventually see the cost drop to $100 a ton or less. In the latest deals, Frontier said on Tuesday, buyers had agreed to pay $48 million or $214 a metric ton for credits representing 224,500 metric tons of emissions between 2028 and 2030 from a project developer CO280 and $32.1 million or $447 a ton for 71,878 tons from New Haven, Connecticut startup CREW. CO280 is bolting carbon capture and storage technology owned by oil field services company SLB onto the smokestack of a paper mill, sucking up carbon initially captured by the trees used to make the paper. Crew, meanwhile, adds carbon-attracting limestone to water at municipal waste plants, testing CO2 levels going in and out of treatment to calculate how much was captured. It's a version of a much discussed process to capitalize on some rocks' natural tendency to capture CO2. Hannah Bennington, head of deployment at Frontier, said the two purchases reflect efforts to retrofit older industries with newer carbon technology. We are really excited about the possibility for large industrial players to integrate carbon removal technologies and start to deliver carbon removal cheaply and at scale, she said. Our next article, how would a Bitcoin strategy reserve work? This is by Gertrude Chavez-Dreyfus and Lisa Pauline McAtal from Reuters. Bitcoin hit a record high above $107,000 on Monday after President-elect Donald Trump reiterated plans to create a U.S. Bitcoin strategic reserve, stoking the enthusiasm for crypto bulls. Here's how the plan could work. The concept. A strategic reserve is a stock of a critical resource which can be released at times of crisis or supply disruptions. The best-known example is the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the world's largest supply of emergency crude oil, which was created by an act of Congress in 1975 after a 1973-74 Arab oil embargo throttled the U.S. economy. Presidents have tapped the stockpile to calm oil markets during war or when hurricanes hit oil infrastructure along the U.S. Gulf of Mexico. Canada has the world's only strategic reserve of maple syrup, while China has strategic reserves of metals, grains, and even pork products. Analysts and legal experts are divided on whether Trump could use his executive powers to create the reserve or whether an act of Congress would be necessary. Some have argued Trump could create the reserve via an executive order directing the U.S. Treasury's Exchange Stabilization Fund, which can be used to purchase or sell foreign currencies and to also hold Bitcoin. The reserve could include Bitcoin that the government has seized from criminal actors that stands at around 200,000 tokens worth about $21 billion at the current price, according to Bitcoin Treasury's net. Trump suggested in a July speech unveiling his Bitcoin reserve plan that this stockpile could be the starting point, although it remains unclear what the legal process would be for moving them out of the Justice Department. Trump has not said if the government would add to that stockpile by buying more Bitcoin in the open market. To do that, the government may have to issue debt, although some proponents of a Bitcoin reserve say the United States could sell some of its gold reserves and use the proceeds to buy Bitcoin. Currently, the most concrete Bitcoin reserve proposal circulated in Washington comes from pro-crypto Republican Senator Cynthia Lummis, who personally holds 5 Bitcoins, she told CNBC last month. In July, she introduced a bill yet to gain traction that would create a reserve operated by the Treasury. The bill envisions that the Treasury would create a program to buy 200,000 Bitcoins annually for 5 years until the stockpile hit 1 million tokens. This would represent about 5% of the total global supply of Bitcoin of around 21 million. The Treasury would fund the purchases with profits on Federal Reserve Bank's deposits and gold holdings. The Bitcoin reserve would subsequently be maintained for a minimum of 20 years. In his July speech, Trump suggested a Bitcoin reserve could help the U.S. dominate the global Bitcoin market in the face of growing competition from China. Other proponents argue that by holding a stockpile of Bitcoin, which they said is likely to continue appreciating over the long term, the U.S. could reduce its deficit without raising taxes, strengthening the U.S. dollar. In November, Lummis told Fox Business that her plan would allow the United States to cut its debt in half in 20 years. What that does is help us protect ourselves against inflation and protect the U.S. dollar on the world stage, she said. A strong dollar would in turn give the United States more leverage over foreign adversaries like China and Russia, proponents say. Risk. Crypto skeptics say that unlike most other commodities, Bitcoin has no intrinsic use and is not critical to the functioning of the U.S. economy. Created in 2008, Bitcoin remains too young and volatile to presume its value will continue to rise in the long term, while crypto wallets remain notoriously vulnerable to cyber attacks, they also argue. And given its volatility, any government purchases or sales could have an outsized impact on Bitcoin's price. Moving to our next article. Retailers that make it harder to return merchandise face backlash, by Hussein Abdullah, University of Tennessee, The Conversation, U.S. In 2018, L.L. Bean ended its century-old lifetime return policy, limiting returns to 1 year after purchase and requiring receipts. The demise of this popular policy sparked backlash, with several customers filing lawsuits. It also inspired my team of operations management researchers to study how customers respond when retailers make their return policies more strict. Our key finding: whether they often or rarely return products they've purchased. Customers object unless those retailers explain why. I work with a group of researchers examining product return policies and how they affect consumers and retailers. As we explained in an article published in the Journal of Operations Management, we designed experiments to study whether and why return policy restrictions irk customers. We also wanted to understand what retailers can do to minimize backslash after making it harder for customers to return stuff. Americans returned products worth an estimated $890 billion to retailers in 2024. Processing a single item typically costs $21 to $46. Most of this merchandise ends up in landfills. The rise of e-commerce and other technology changes have contributed to this trend. Another factor is the ease with which consumers may return stuff long after making a purchase and get a full refund. Many other retailers besides L.L. Bean have done away with their long-standing lenient return policies. Over the past decade, for example, Macy's, a department store chain, and Kohl's, a big box clothing store chain, have shortened the time frames for returns. Macy's restricted its open-ended return window to 1 year in 2016. Further windowing to 180 days in 2017, then to 90 days in 2019. It then stopped accepting returns after 30 days in 2023. Kohl's didn't have any time limit on returns it would accept until 2019. Then it imposed a 180-day limit. Others, such as fast fashion giants Zara and H&M, now charge the customers fees when they return merchandise. However, research shows that customers value no-questions-asked return policies and see them as a sign of high-quality service. And when these arrangements become the industry standard, customers can get angry if retailers fail to meet it. Interesting, most retailers that restrict their policies don't tell customers directly. Instead, they quietly updated the new policies on websites, store displays, and receipts. Although not drawing attention to bad news might appear prudent, as most customers wouldn't notice the changes that way, dozens of threads on Reddit about these changes suggest that that isn't always true. Moving to our next article, retail statistics showcase economy's enduring strength, by Lucia Butticani, Reuters. U.S. retail sales increased more than expected in November as households increased purchases of motor vehicles and online merchandise, consistent with strong underlying momentum in the economy as the year winds down. The report from U.S. Department of Commerce on Tuesday had no impact on expectations that the Federal Reserve would cut interest rates on Wednesday for the third time since the U.S. Central Bank initiated its policy easing cycle in September. Fed officials started a two-day policy meeting on Tuesday. Signs of strong domestic demand added to warmer inflation readings in recent months, in suggesting that the Fed could pause rate cuts in January. Policies planned by President-elect Donald Trump's incoming administration, including tariffs on imports and mass deportations of undocumented immigrants, are also seen complicating matters for the central bank. The market is still discounting a 25 basis points rate cut tomorrow. But if consumers are still buying interest-sensitive goods like autos, a rational markets observer would have to wonder why would a central bank add fuel to the fire with a president-elect coming in at the end of January with one of the most pro-growth agendas of any president in history, said Christopher Rupke, chief economist at Forward Bonds. Retail sales jumped 0.7% last month after an upward revised 0.5% gain in October, the Commerce Department's Census Bureau said. Economists polled by Reuters had forecast retail sales, which are mostly goods and are not adjusted for inflation, advancing 0.5%. Estimates ranged from a 0.1% dip to a 1% surge. Retail sales increased 3.8% year on year in November. Labor market resilience, characterized by historically low layoffs and strong wage growth, is underpinning consumer spending. Strong household balance sheets reflecting record stock market prices and high home prices are also driving spending. Household savings remained supportive. Economists expect policymakers will signal fewer rate cuts in 2025 when they update their summary of economic projections on Wednesday. The Fed's benchmark overnight interest rate is currently in the 4.5% to 4.75% range, having been hiked by 5.2 percentage points between March 2022 and July 2023. Unless the labor market materially weakens, investors should expect the Fed to ease rates next year, but not as much as originally hoped, said Jeffrey Roach, chief economist at LPL Financial. That's all the time we have left for the Arizona Daily Sun. For Sun Sounds of Arizona and Flagstaff, I'm volunteer reader Gary. Thanks for listening.